appellant because there's water spilled all over the athlete's table.
Noticed.
We're ready for you, Mr. Overman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You get a reserve in my vote. Never mind.
This is the first all around, Your Honor. My first unopposed and my first Commonwealth's appeal. If the court permits, I'd like to first address the procedural questions that the court posed by email.
Which, as you unpack them, probably pose additional procedural questions that we'll get to. But
yes, Your Honor, I'm aware. The first question the court asked is, was the first order, the June 8, 2017 order, a final order for purposes of Rule 1:1? My response to that is no, it was not. That June 8, 2017 order erroneously dismissed the charge against Mr. Berry. There was no motion to dismiss before the trial court at that time. Rather, it was just being heard on a motion to suppress. I think this is further evident as a result of the second order dated August 3, 2017, in which the trial court stated, quote, the order entered on June 8, 2017 also erroneously dismissed the case, unquote. The second order further stated that it, quote, vacates the dismissal portion of the June 8, 2017 order. And for that reason, because it vacated that portion, at least on the surface of that first order, which otherwise would have made it appear final, it's the Commonwealth's position that the first order, the June 8, 2017 order, was not final. And I think this leads directly into the court's second question, which is consistent with Rule 1:1. Did the lower court have jurisdiction to enter the August 3rd, 2017 order? Here, I think it's helpful to know, first of all, I believe the answer is yes. And I believe the answer is yes because that second order, that August 3rd order, essentially amounted to an order under Code Section 8.01-428B to correct a Scrivener's error. And
wait, what's a Scrivener's error?
Yes, Your Honor, a Scrivener's error. And I will explain.
Okay.
Well, if an entire missing transcript can be a Scrivener's error, evidently it's more than just a typo.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, and I will explain, 428B provides that clerical mistakes in all judgments or other parts of the record and errors therein arising from oversight or from inadvertent admission may be considered, or may be corrected, rather, by the trial court at any time. And this court last year, November 2016, in an opinion authored by Judge Russell in Minor versus Commonwealth, applied that civil code section in the criminal context. And there, the court held that pursuant to Code 8.01-428B, a trial court has jurisdiction after Rule 1:1's 21-day period has run for the limited purpose of correcting errors and omissions in previously entered orders. The court continued, in short, the court has the inherent power, the trial court, that is, has the inherent power, independent of the statute, upon any competent evidence to make the record speak the truth. And it's the Commonwealth's position that in correcting that second order, which corrected the first order and vacated the erroneous language dismissing the charge, which the court clearly noted it did not intend to include in the order, had the effect of correcting that oversight that was in the order.
And there are different ways to get there, and I have a feeling we're going to ask you questions, and you may be here for longer than 15 minutes.
I understand, Your Honor.
But if you get there under Minor, then aren't you stuck, and as you know, I'm somewhat familiar with that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then aren't you stuck with the problem that Minor says, that means the order relates back, and therefore the appellate time and everything runs from the June 3rd order?
Correct,
I mean, the June 8th order. It's the August 3rd order, the June 8th order. And, of course, there was at one point a viable appeal of the June 8th order, which wasn't withdrawn. It was attempted to be withdrawn, but it was actually dismissed by this court.
Yes, Your Honor.
On November 16th.
Yes.
So if you're there under 428B and the appeal relates back to, all that does is say that the appeal relates back to the date of the order, and I think that's what Minor says. If you disagree with me, tell me. It's what Minor was intended to say, whether it says it or not. Aren't you out?
Your Honor, there are two. I'll address your question in 2 points, if the court will permit. First, I think Minor is somewhat distinguishable there. Of course, the amended order took place more than 21 days after the entry of a sentencing order. And it was, which is, of course, the final order in criminal context. And it was amended, as the court knows, to include a criminal record number that was simply omitted by oversight in the original sentencing order. That then resulted, that amended order resulted in a flurry of motions, including a motion to withdraw guilty pleas, et cetera. And this court held, essentially, you cannot bootstrap motions that were filed subsequent to an amended order. That essentially, the court has lost its plenary jurisdiction. The trial court has lost its plenary jurisdiction at that point. And in that case, there was certainly no doubt that it was a final order. In this case, however, obviously, it's a pretrial appeal. Mr. Berry has yet to be tried. And I would point out to the court the language that the trial court used in its second order, in addition to vacating the dismissal portion of the first, says that it hereby also grants the defendant's motion to suppress. And it's from that portion of the order that the Commonwealth appeals and that we're pursuing today.
If we halt over either through 428B or holding 19.2400 was an automatic, imposed an automatic suspension as we have in a couple of unpublished opinions. If we go over that, aren't we left with a situation where the Commonwealth essentially got two bites at the appellate apple here? And I guess my concern is the limited right of the Commonwealth's appeal, and all the cases talk about how everything has to be strictly construed. If the Commonwealth had a right to appeal the June 8th order as it was, even with the erroneous dismissal language, and our cases suggest that you can, in fact, and then we remanded the trial court to fix any problems with that if we overrule the motion to suppress. If we do that, if it had that right, attempted to exercise that right, and then for whatever reason, whether strategy or for other reason, allowed that one to die, isn't that the Commonwealth's one bite at the apple? Because if not, then doesn't the Commonwealth essentially get two appeals here?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, and I'll explain why. I think in this case, at least on the face of the first order, it served to dismiss the case. And the prosecutor noted in the motion before the trial court that on its face, it was an order that the Commonwealth could not appeal.
Except in multiple times we see that, and your office has consistently appealed orders that contain that dismissal language. And on multiple occasions, we've noted, now granted, we don't tend not to publish our Commonwealth's appeals anymore, so they're all unpublished cases, have said trial court can't do that because that would defeat the Commonwealth's appeal. In one published case in West, we note that you couldn't do that because it would defeat the Commonwealth's right of appeal. And so we've made it, I think, relatively clear that you can appeal even if the court includes the dismissal language, because if we reverse, then we remand the whole thing back because the whole thing's suspended while the appeal's going on. So you still have. So it seems to me the Commonwealth either has to say, we wouldn't have been able, absent the motion to reconsider, we couldn't have appealed the case at all, which I don't think the Commonwealth wants to say, or we had the ability and therefore the obligation to pursue the first appeal that we then abandoned.
I understand, Your Honor. In the prosecutor's motion for reconsideration before the court, for what it's worth, as the court knows, the prosecutor noted that it could not appeal. I understand.
I understand. He said he thought he couldn't appeal.
Yes, sir.
That's not the Commonwealth's position, is it? The Commonwealth believes he could appeal it.
Yes, Your Honor.
And since he could, granted he was erroneous, since he could. When the Commonwealth could appeal that, did appeal that, and conducted the appeal in such a way to get it dismissed by this court, doesn't that have to be the end of the appellate process, or by definition, the Commonwealth's getting a second bite at the end?
Your Honor, I can't concede that point at oral argument. I think what I would...
You don't want to footnote that says with credible candor?
Are you familiar with the West case?
Your Honor, I've researched many cases in response to the court's appeal.
The published case where the Commonwealth noted an appeal, then filed a motion to reconsider, and the court reconsidered the appeal. The defense appealed the conviction, saying that the Commonwealth, that the court did not have the jurisdiction to reconsider the appeal. And that was the case in which we said, yes, we do actually have the authority. The purpose of the Commonwealth's right to appeal is just The court can't take any dispositive action on the case. It would be a case which would probably help your position, I would think.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. That's all right. I don't want to put you on the spot anymore.
Understood, Your Honor. Understood.
It's an old case. It was handled by your predecessor, Marla Graff.
Understood, Your Honor. Understood.
Before the Decker part.
Yes.
Understood. The only other thing that I would know, and I certainly do intend to have full candor with the court. It's not my intent at all. The only other thing I would note is that in this court's dismissal order on November 16th of this year, dismissing the first appeal, it did note that the court lacked jurisdiction. It did not obtain jurisdiction over that first appeal because the petition for appeal was not filed.
Because the Commonwealth had abandoned it.
Correct, Your
Honor. The Commonwealth abandoned its appeal in this case unless it gets a second one. I mean, I think you understand
the
difficulty I'm having.
I'm trying to walk the tightrope. I understand the court's position. I understand.
Well, it's not my position yet. I'm really having trouble with this one.
Assuming that we get to the merits.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree that at the time of the hearing on the on a motion to suppress, that there was an understanding that appears to have been voiced by the Commonwealth attorney, that there was an issue regarding the stop, and there was an issue regarding the search, and that the Commonwealth on that particular day was prepared, because a witness was ill, to only go forward on the first part, the stop?
Yes, Your Honor. I would also couch that in terms of that defense counsel had posited to the court that it had intended to only go forward with respect to the stop itself. And it had, in fact, the prosecutor noted, as Chief Judge, as you just mentioned, that an absence or a witness was very ill, that was a drug distribution witness, and the defense attorney got up and advised that he was only going to proceed with respect to the stop itself.
So best case scenario, if we agree with your position, you wind up going back, and you still have the other half of that motion to suppress to deal with. Is that correct?
It is in writing, Your Honor. The defense motion is in writing based upon that. So yes, I don't think that the defendant would be barred from proceeding on that portion of his written motion pending this court's decision in this matter, simply because it wasn't presented to the trial court.
In the initial appeal of the June 8th order,
yes,
the substantive issue on the motion to suppress, what this court would be asked to decide, is identical to the issue in this appeal of the August 3rd order. It's the exact same issue. It's everything's the same. The evidence is the same. Everything's the same as the substance of suppression issue.
It is, Your Honor. And it's the Commonwealth's position that the trial court was entitled to correct that error in its first order. And then it did so essentially, as noted, the Commonwealth.
But that was not necessary for this court to obtain appellate jurisdiction on the first one. We could have decided that one on the merits, regardless of what the trial court did with the...
If it had proceeded, yes, Your Honor. And the best response I have to that is when this court entered the order on November 16, 2017, dismissing that petition for lack of jurisdiction. This court has previously held that assignments error are jurisdictional, petitions for appeal are jurisdictional, that the trial court was not divested of jurisdiction because of that. And if I could just very briefly address the merits, if the court will allow me, I'll give the court the elevator clip notes version. In this case...
Can you do it in one word? Mason?
Mason. Mason, Your Honor. It's the Commonwealth's position that the trial court misinterpreted Mason. As this court is certainly well aware of, Mason dealt with the issue of an obstructed view under Code Section 46.2-1054. And in that case, as this court held en banc, as the Supreme Court of Virginia affirmed, the court held that a police officer could pull over a vehicle if a reasonable police officer in that officer's position could have objectively found that the traffic offense might have occurred, and therefore the Supreme Court at least drew a distinction between articulable and articulated suspicion, reasonable suspicion. And in this case, the trial court essentially applied that rubric for Mason regarding obstructed views which of course, to the extent instructive view is relevant, we're going to need to know the size of the object. And in this case, the court included a 3.5 plastic. It was an exhibit.
But by definition, that wasn't known to the officer, that card wasn't known until after the
correct.
Stop.
Correct. And that's because, again, articulable is different than articulated, and we're putting ourselves in the position of an objective police officer. Here, there was a crack in the windshield, which is a defect under 46.2-1003, and just simply by the very nature that there was, in fact, a crack in the windshield would have been sufficient for the officer to have further investigated the matter. In Myree versus Commonwealth, which is cited on brief, it's an unpublished opinion, but there the court held that a cracked windshield may be a defective windshield and held before stopping the defendant, the officer observed that the windshield of the defendant's car was cracked. Your Honor.
If the trial court had said, I don't believe him that the windshield was cracked, then you would lose.
Yes, Your Honor.
But
yes.
As I understood what the fact finder found was, I haven't been given enough detail about where the crack is, how it might affect, et cetera. The trial court found that, credited that there was a crack in the windshield, or the officer believed there was a crack in the windshield. It just went to, its decision went off on not knowing where and how big and all of that. He did not reject that the windshield was cracked.
And Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I respond to the court's question?
I told you I was going to take you
away. Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. In this case, the court noted that there was a crack. It was not a starburst. On page 31 of the appendix, the trial court said, the facts of this case, there's no location where the crack is, there's no description of the crack, nothing other than I remember a cracked windshield. And it's the Commonwealth's position that what the trial court is doing there is applying the very specific rubric in Mason, which again is pertinent to whether a view is obstructed, to simply an equipment defect violation to which the view doesn't matter. All that matters is the existence of the crack.
And very well. Thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel. We appreciate the argument.
I thank the court for its time. Thank you.